So the exam hasn't changed since I last talked to you about it. It's still 13 multiple choice questions and 5 short answer and 5 problem type questions. Just like any exam, you can have one side of an 8.5 and 11 sheet. You can write formulas and words, but I kind of don't want to see worked problems. If you want, you can start 10 minutes early, and if you want, you can stay 10 minutes late. One thing that's new is there are screencasts of all of the quizzes from 191. So if you want to look at some more screencasts, they're all there in kind of the usual place, right? Click on lectures, click on FIS 191-2002 folder. And then these things, I think, have the name 191Q4211.mp4. Quizzes 1 through 3 were already there as a screencast.
Where are the problems on the exam? Like which
topic? I'm not going to tell you exactly, but if you think about the big topics, well, so one way of thinking about, I guess I don't have those things handy. So, I mean, energy conservation, right? Collisions and momentum conservation, some sort of rotation, statics, those free body diagrams with rotations. I mean, those are kind of the big, those are the titles of the chapters, right? So if you think about it, there are 5 questions and there are 4 chapters, right? So pretty much should expect 1 question from each chapter, and some lucky chapter gets 2 questions. So kind of another way of answering that question is you could take a look at the what we did with group work. So those group work problems are, the solutions are online as a PDF. Typically your PDFs, your answers, and you can see what the distribution of those were. Oh, so there was kind of a centripetal acceleration problem on that one, I can remember, but I think that might be the only additional type thing. More questions? Okay, so here's what people have already told me as questions, so I might as well kind of go down the line. So chapter 5, problem 81, page 165 is the POGO problem. And what we have is, I'm not going to try and draw the kid, we've got a spring that is compressed, and that is listed as situation A. And then we have the spring that is uncompressed, so there's no potential energy at this point, and the thing is moving upwards, and that's labeled situation B. And then the guy is flying upwards to some maximum height. Spring is, of course, still sitting here uncompressed, and that's labeled situation C. And we're told that we're given the spring constant of the spring, which is 2.5 times 10 to the fourth. Newtons per meter. And we're told that in that first situation, the spring is compressed by 10 centimeters. And we're supposed to find the total energy in the system. They tell us that the potential energy is supposed to be zero when the spring is uncompressed. So this is apparently height equals zero. They could have chosen it someplace else, but they wanted it there. And we're supposed to determine how high the person goes, the speed at various spots, where's the kinetic energy is a maximum, etc. So kind of answering deep into this first, what is the value of x where the kinetic energy is a maximum?
Well,
So that's saying, where is the speed a maximum? And that's, of course, where the force goes from being net up, because as long as the force is net up, then you're accelerating, to where it's going down. So where is the force zero? Well, the spring is partially compressed, and it's making some force up, which is k times the amount of compression. And of course, gravity is down, which is mg. So if we just have zero force, so we're no longer accelerating, then what has to be the case is that kx has to be mg. So the amount of compression, and this would be a negative number if we're using the book's notation, would be mg divided by k. And the whole system weighs 25 kilograms. So we've got 25 kilograms times 9.8 divided by the spring constant, 2.5 times 10 to the fourth. And we've got basically 0.01 centimeters, but if we, or excuse me, 0.01 meters, 1 centimeter, but if we want the actual number, 9.8 times 10 to the minus 3 meters. Okay, so it's compressed 10 centimeters, for a full 9 centimeters, the net force on it is up. But for that last centimeter, gravity is bigger than the spring force, and it's starting to slow down. Okay, so that the rest of this problem has to do with energy conservation. That little bit didn't have to do with energy conservation. So what is energy? Well, in general, we have kinetic energy plus potential energy. And in this particular problem, we've got gravitational potential energy, MGH, and we've got spring potential energy. Question?
So only for like a split second does kx equal mg, right?
Correct.
It's not the entire, it's only at that place where acceleration is zero?
Right. So he's always going faster, 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 but at a slower rate, and then the force is zero at an instant, literally an instant, and then he, from there on in, he's slowing down, reach some maximum altitude, and then come back down. Yes?
Why are you using kx instead of 1/2?
Because I'm talking forces, right? So this is the formula for potential energy. The formula for force, I'll put in the minus sign this time, is minus kx. So I was relating gravity force to spring force.
And then why did you lose the negative?
Well, so the negative there is just telling us direction. So maybe I should have been a little bit more careful about all my signs and put in like all of these negative signs. But I didn't. All the negative sign is doing is telling us the direction, and I like to put the arrow for the direction. And even the book isn't that consistent. So I think I've commented that, technically speaking, because the force of gravity is a attractive force, we should have a minus there, just like we have a minus kx for the spring. So if they're cheating, it's fair game for me to cheat. More questions on this piece of it.
So we are fully done with A right now.
We just did whatever was part D. We haven't even done part one yet. Part A. I just skipped to the one part that doesn't have to do with conservation of energy. So that's why forces were part of this answer, and they're not going to appear again, I don't think, in the rest of this problem. More questions? Okay, so back to conservation of energy. We have gravitational potential energy because we are at a height that is minus 0.1. And we've got spring energy that is plus, potential energy always has the plus sign here, plus x squared. Of course, it's squared, so it doesn't matter whether it's minus. And we have zero kinetic energy because we're starting at rest. So we'll calculate in a minute what that number is, but let's take a look at the maximum height position and figure out what's going to go on there. So in case C, we again have kinetic energy zero because we're at rest. In terms of potential energy, the spring, let me get rid of that because it's confusing, the spring is uncompressed. It's not extended or anything. And we have gravitational potential energy that is mgh, and h is what we're trying to find. How high did this guy go? So our total energy in the final situation, no potential energy of spring, no kinetic energy, all of the energy is in the form of gravitational potential energy. In this initial state, no kinetic energy, but we have energy both in the spring and negative energy in terms of gravity. Okay, so let's work it out with what we've got. So our initial energy is the mass times g times the initial height. They declared that the height was zero at a particular spot, and we're at a height that's minus 0.1 meter. And then we have the spring constant. The spring is compressed by 0.1 squared. And all of this energy has to end up in potential energy of height. And we can solve that guy for height. I don't know if it's worth doing a little bit of algebra. We do have 25 and 9.8 as common factors, so maybe I will divide this whole equation by mgh. So I've got this remaining, and I've got the 1/2 of the 2.5 times 10 to the 4th times 0.1 squared all over 25 times 9.8. So all that is supposed to equal h. Okay, so we got 2.5 and our exponent 4. We got 0.1 squared times it, and half of all of that, and we're supposed to divide that by 25 and 9.8. So incidentally, for this piece of it, I get basically 0.5, and then I want to subtract 0.1, and the precise answer I get then is 0.41 meters. Okay, so that's the full height that he goes. I'm not sure I'm answering these in anything like the order they have them. Okay, so I did x2, that's part B. Calculate the speed of the child at x equals zero. Okay, so it's the same sort of situation. So under this situation, so we're talking about the energy at B. We have an unknown amount of kinetic energy. That's basically what we're supposed to calculate. We have an uncompressed spring because x is equal to zero. And we're at height equals zero. So this same initial energy that we had before is now all kinetic energy. So all I have to do is add all that stuff up and multiply it by 2 and divide by the mass. And I should get the square, take the square root, and I should get the velocity. Oh, so it's that simple, huh? Okay, so I'm kind of running out of nice board space. Well, why don't I just calculate this right-hand side, since it's left-hand side, since it's been sitting around for a while. So I've got 2.5 and exponent 4, the 0.1 squared, and half of that, and I've got the 25 and the 9.8 and the minus 0.1. Well, that's kind of a nice round number. So this is 100.5 joules. So now what I've got is 100.5 joules is supposed to be 1/2 times the mass, which is 25 kilograms, times the velocity squared. So the velocity should be 2 times that 100.5 divided by 25 square rooted. So 2 times that, 25 divided by square rooted, and I get 2.84. So that's part C. We did part D, and E obtained the child's maximum speed upward. So the maximum speed occurs at this magic spot, and basically all we have to do, and I'm not, the algebra is going to get moderately ugly, so I'm not sure I'm going to do it. So to answer that, we're going to have, at this point, a certain amount of spring potential energy, because the spring is going to be compressed by that amount. And we're going to have a certain amount of gravitational potential energy. This is a negative number. And that thing's going to go in there. So unknown kinetic energy, we can calculate these quantities. And we know it all has to equal what it had originally, namely that total amount of energy. So the only unknown there is kinetic energy. We could plug and chug through it.
So in general, with questions on the exam, would you expect us to go from A to B to C to D, or would you expect us to go
I try, don't always succeed, in not having multiple part questions like this. So some of the ones that were on the group work that we did had multiple parts, but I'll try. I mean, this had, 5 multiple parts? I hope not to go that far. 2 multiple parts I think I can live with. Incidentally, the general rule when there are multiple parts and you can't get the first part is it's usually fair game to assume any number you want for the first part and then calculate the second part, just to show that you could do it. But
would you give us a card for that if you didn't know how to do the first part, but you could do the second part?
Yeah, so just pick any old number you want as your answer to the first part and use it for the second part. More questions?
Could you just go through a couple of problems that are that would possibly be on the test? Just one from each chapter, do you think?
Well, so I've got a list of things to do. I mean, there's nothing wrong with this problem except that it's got 4 parts, right? So you could pick any one of those parts and it would make a perfectly good question. Right? So kind of a very standard question is to ask how high this thing goes, right? And in some sense, there's no reason to do it multiple times, right? It's all energy conservation, right? Once you calculate the initial energy, all you're doing thereafter is setting it equal to the final energy. Mm-hmm. And they're just different formulas for the final energy depending upon where you are. So if you can do one part, you can probably do all the other parts. And of course, if you can't do one part, you probably can't do all the other parts. And inventing a number as an answer to the previous one isn't going to help you. Because they're basically totally unrelated, except that they all use energy conservation. Questions about this problem? Okay, so exam 3, number 7. Exam 3, number 7, really? So that's a multiple choice question, huh? Oh, it's really exam 4. Oh, okay. I didn't have exam 4 on that. I could get it, but if you have it handy, it'll be faster. Oh, so this is a triangle. Incidentally, there's a worked problem like this that's in this list of 191 quizzes. So if you want another example of this. So there's a triangle of masses. This one's 11 kilograms, this one's 5 kilograms, and this one is 7 kilograms. and we're going to put an object where the x is that has a mass of 2 kilograms, and we're supposed to figure out what the force is on that particle. And we're talking gravity, so we're talking about this formula with or without the minus sign. So kind of ballparking it. Oops, I guess the other number I need is what one of these sides are. Is it 0.3?
0.3 meters.
So 7 kilograms is more than 5 kilograms, so the attractive force that this guy feels to this guy is going to be bigger than the attractive force it feels to that guy. And there's also going to be an attractive force to this guy. This guy weighs a lot more, but it's also more distant, so it's hard to kind of compare what that force is going to be to the other one. But the net force, of course, has to kind of go like this, right? It has to point in the negative x direction and the positive y direction. And all we have to do is figure out what those three forces are and add them up. So this force, for example, an attractive force that's in the positive x direction, is going to be g, you don't have to remember this number, 6.67 times 10 to the minus 11th. Is that what it is? I would give you that number. I don't have it memorized. The product of the masses divided by the distance squared. And so we need this distance here. This is an equilateral triangle, so this is 30 degrees. So we need the sine of 30 degrees. So this side here is the hypotenuse times the sine of 30 degrees. Sine of 30 degrees is a half, so this is 0.15 meters. Yeah, yep, thank you. Yep, that's a faster way. The midpoint is the midpoint. Yep, I agree. But we're agreeing on the answer. Your way is 10 times faster, though. And similarly, this force here is in the minus x direction. So it's going to be, I can put in the minus sign, 2g times the product of the masses divided by the distance squared. And this force here, this positive y force, is going to be g times the mass times the 11 mass divided by this distance squared. And here, I do have to use some trigonometry. Or you could use Pythagoras if you wanted to. But I'm going to use geometry. This is going to be 0.3 times the cosine of 30 degrees. So I need to square that too. So the net result, I'm not sure I'm going to pull out my calculator and calculate it. This is the component of the force in the y direction. And the sum, it looks like the difference of those two numbers, is the force in the x direction. And notice that it's negative, because 7 weighs more than 5.
Is that how you give the answer, do you somehow add those
together? It would kind of depend on exactly how the question was phrased, but if nothing else is said, this is a perfectly good way to do it. You could imagine that the question might ask you to do some vector stuff, in which case you might want to find the magnitude, which you'd use Pythagoras for, and then calculate the angle. But I won't do that, right, because that's an intentional bringing back of a previous test, right? So it's a good question for the final, but I won't have you ad hoc figuring out vectors. You shouldn't have to push your magic button on this exam. The cylinder one?
Yes.
Okay, I'll put it on the list. Okay, so exam 2, 15, and 17. I think I do have those if I look around for them a little bit. Oops, I pushed the wrong button. Okay, so 17 is the bungee jumper one, And 15 is the car problem. And the car problem is the easier one, so let's take a look at that one. So the setup is we've got a turn that has a radius of 100 meters. The coefficient of static friction is 0.3. And we're supposed to figure out how fast you could go around this corner without skidding. So if we draw a free body diagram, so this is a back view of the car going along this road. It has a mass and therefore a weight. There's a normal force that is pushing it up, and those things have to balance because there's no acceleration in the y direction. There is acceleration in the x direction because it's going around in a circle. So the acceleration is centripetal and it's v squared over r. If there is an acceleration in that direction, there better be a force in that direction because forces cause acceleration. So there has to be a force. You go down the list of forces, the only force this could be is friction. So it must be that the frictional force has to be producing that acceleration. And we know that the biggest possible value of the frictional force is the static coefficient of friction times the normal force. And a moment ago we said that the normal force was just mg. So if we cancel off the m's, we have mu static times g is an upper limit for v squared over r. So if I bring the r up, mu static g times r is an upper limit for v squared. So the biggest possible value of v is equal to mu static g times r. So mu static is 0.3. The one number you do have to know is g, it's 9.8, and the radius of the circle is 100 meters. So I've got 9.8, 100 times it, 0.3 times that, take the square root, and I get 17.1 meters per second. Questions on that?
Where did the mass come from in the friction equations? I'm not picking up.
Here?
No.
Here.
Squared over R, yeah.
So that's Newton, right? Newton says that the sum of the forces equals mass times the acceleration.
Oh, okay.
And the acceleration is v squared over R. More questions? Okay, the bungee jumping problem. So this is kind of like the pogo stick in reverse. We're just talking about springs and gravity. So it's so the bungee jumper starts. So here's kind of the loose bungee cord. The bungee cord jumper starts 5 meters above how long the bungee cord would be if it wasn't holding on to anyone. And so, of course, what's going to happen is he's going to fall down the 5 meters with just gravity being present. And then the bungee cord is going to start to hold, and it's going to stretch. And I think what we're supposed to calculate is where this guy ends up, how far the bungee cord stretches. So it's energy conservation. Kinetic energy, always 1/2 mv squared, unless we have some rotation, I guess. mgh for the potential energy of gravity. And the first thing you should ask when you see that equation is, where is height equals zero? It's a choice. It's not a requirement. And I like to take height equals zero at the same spot where the bungee cord starts to bite. So that means that the initial energy is all gravitational potential energy. The initial energy is just mg times this 5 meters. What's the situation when he's reached his maximum stretch? Well, again, he's stopped instantaneously, so there's no kinetic energy. There will be some, let's call this distance x. There will be some stretched bungee cord, so that's bungee cord potential energy that is 1/2 kx squared. And he's at an altitude that is minus x. So he has that for gravitational potential energy. And the sum of all of these things has to be the initial energy, which was mg times 5 meters. Now, I don't know if it's going to pay, but I'm going to divide every... are we given the mass of this guy? And we're given the bungee cord strength. Huh? The bungee cord has a spring constant of 60 newtons per meter. And his mass is 80 kilograms. Well, I'm tempted to just divide through by mg because I kind of get 2 for 1. So I'm going to do that. 5 minus x. It doesn't really help a whole lot. I have this kind of ugly constant times x squared. So what is it? It's a quadratic equation, right? Well, we're going to call that thing C, so we might as well calculate it once and for all. So we've got the 60, we've got the divide by 2, and we've got the divide by his mass, which is 80, and divide by G. And so this number, which I'm going to call A, is 3.83 times 10 to the minus 2. So if I put everything together, I've got ax squared minus x minus 5 is 0. And the solution to quadratic equations are the opposite of b. So b is minus 1, so the opposite of that is plus 1, plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4 times a. A is minus 5 times C is minus 5 times A all over 2A. So minus and minus is plus. So this thing is going to end up 1 plus or minus the square root of 1 minus 20 times A all over A. 1 plus 20. And we're looking for x to be positive, so we're looking to use the plus sign in that quadratic. Okay, so 20 times a, add 1 to it, take the square root. I get 1.333 for this quantity. So I'm going to add 1 to that, and then I'm going to divide by a, and I get 6.09 meters. Thank you. It is. I get 3.04 meters. Yes?
That's different from what you have on your screencast.
Oh, is that different from what I have?
Yeah, it's supposed to be 30.4.
A little bit louder?
It's supposed to be 30.4.
You're right. It is on my calculator, too. I could lie, I guess. It's in scientific notation. I didn't notice the E1. That's a big bungee jump. So, the final answer is, where do you reach equilibrium? And that's just a force equilibrium, right? So in equilibrium, the bungee cord is pushing up with a force that is kx, and gravity is pushing down, that is mg. So x is going to be mg over over k. So he's going to end up, you know, someplace around here after bouncing around for a long period of time, down by this distance x.
And that's just x equals mg over k?
Yes, yes. So that's force equality. The spring force is kx, pulling up, and gravity is pulling down mg. And again, I'm playing loose with my signs, but I think it's fair to. More questions?
What's the difference between angular acceleration and centripetal acceleration?
Okay. I guess I have to be a little bit careful. So we've got alpha, we've got tangential acceleration, and we've got centripetal acceleration. So angular acceleration is really totally different from all of these things. It has different units. So angular acceleration is just how many revolutions per second is it going faster every second. So it's like free fall. It is very closely related to the tangential acceleration. So if something is going around in a circle and is increasing in speed, it of course has a centripetal acceleration, an acceleration towards the center, but if it's going ever faster, it'll also have a tangential acceleration. Is that okay? So we've mostly talked about things going at constant speeds, and so alpha was zero, and so there was no tangential acceleration, and so the only acceleration was towards the center of the circle. The centripetal acceleration, which is v squared over r. But if something is not just going in a circle at a constant speed, but it's going faster and faster and faster, then there should be a component of acceleration that's along the circumference of the circle. And that's called the tangential acceleration, and it's equal to alpha times r. The direction. So these two are both accelerations. They'd both be measured in meters per second squared. This one is towards the center of the circle. This one is tangential to the circle.
And then what makes the top different?
Totally different units. Right? So just as omega and speed are kind of analogous but totally different things, right? Omega is revolutions per minute and speed is miles per hour. Same thing is going on here. So this is angular acceleration. How much faster the record player is going.
In class, it was when we were talking about rotation, you talked about some values that had to be in like radians per second and some that had to be in degrees or something. Can you just go over those again?
Yep. So this is one, and any one that is similar to that is on that same list. So for example, that the velocity is omega r, or that the displacement is r times theta, all of those require radian measurement. And what we did is sometimes we plugged in this for velocity and we got omega squared r. And since we plugged that in, this equation also, omega has to be in radians a second. So these four equations are 100% of what has to be in radians. Other questions? Yes?
Are we going to be able, on our sheets, are we allowed to write the little force versus time?
Oh, yeah, you can write words just fine. Yep. Oh, yeah, yep. That little stack of graphs. Yep. Anything that's ever been on this board as a review board is fair game, and that's been on lots of them. There's a question here too. No, here.
Are we really gonna see Kepler's law kind of stuff? Because I know we talked about it in class, but not a lot.
Hmm. Yeah, so we did talk about it a little bit in class, and we worked a little bit of problems on it. Well, I guess I will tell you that Kepler's law plays no role in any of the five big problems, but Kepler's law will play a role in kind of the multiple choice questions. So I would call that a secondary topic that needs to be on some exam, but it doesn't deserve a full problem.
Can you review what it is?
Say again?
Can you review what it is?
Oh, what Kepler's laws are? So Kepler's laws are that the orbits are ellipses with the sun at a focus. And Kepler's second law is this kind of hard to remember aerial velocity law. It says that the area that a planet sweeps out from the sun is constant, but a much easier way to remember it is that omega r squared has to be a constant. And the third law relates the time it takes to go around for different planets. So this law here talks about the timing of a planet. It's moving fast when it's close to the sun, it's moving slow when it's away from the sun. Very similar sounding things when you compare Pluto, say, to Mercury. And then it turns out that the period squared divided by the semi-major axis cubed is a constant. And the semi-major axis is the big radius of the ellipse. More questions? Okay, so we handed out that surprise quiz that wasn't, where we had the penny on the turntable. So you remember a turntable is one of these old devices that you put vinyl on and it goes around at 33 and a third or 45 or 78 RPMs. And the claim was that if you put the penny close enough to the spin axis, it'll stay put. It'll go around with the record. But if you put it too far, it will slide off. So the free body diagram is exactly like for the car, right? So if this is a side view of the platter, here's the spindle and here's the penny. Since this thing is going in a circle, it has an acceleration. We know that that acceleration is given by the centripetal formula, and you can pay your money, take your choice, omega squared r, v squared over r, both of them are true formulas. Forces that are obvious are gravity and the normal force, and they have to be equal and opposite since there's no acceleration in the y direction, but that can't be the full story because something must be pushing it around in a circle. There has to be a force pushing this way that is pushing this thing around in a circle, keeping it from going in a straight line, which is what Newton would say would happen otherwise. So you go down the list of forces, this has to be friction. Friction is what is pushing it around in a circle. So if we use our free body diagram, we have the normal force minus gravity is zero because there's no acceleration in the y direction. And we have the frictional force is causing the centripetal acceleration, which is v squared over r. We know that the frictional force is always less than the coefficient of friction, static coefficient of friction times the normal force. And we know that the normal force is just mg. So we're back exactly where we were with the car. Mu static times g is v squared over r. Oops, maybe I should put an inequality there, right? You can go slow just fine. But if you try and get the speed too fast, it won't be static friction anymore, it'll be kinetic friction. So I think we were supposed to calculate what the static coefficient of friction was for particular numbers. Do you have those numbers handy? I don't know if it matters or not. So I think it was 10 centimeters and 33 or 45. Okay, so I'll say omega in quotes was 45 revolutions per minute, and the radius was 10 centimeters. I wanted to put that omega in quote because if I use the if I use the omega squared r, I have to convert that to radians a second. So let's do that. There are two pi radians in a rev, and in 1 minute, they're 60 seconds. So I can calculate out what this omega is in radians a second. So we got, oops, turn it around, 45, 2 times it, pi times it, and 60 divided by it, and I get 4.71 radians per second. So mu static is omega squared, this omega, times the radius, 0.1, divided by g, which is 9.8. And I get 0.227. And coefficients of friction are dimensionless. Now, this problem is similar but different to this problem. So we're going in a circle. So that's the common feature. We have a centripetal acceleration. And of course, we've got gravity, so gravity is going down. What's different is kind of the role of friction and the role of the normal force. So friction has to act parallel to the surface that you're on, so it must be frictional force that's holding you up. And I think that kind of makes sense. If that were sandpaper, you'd stick better than if it were slick steel. So the normal force acts perpendicular to the surface, so it must be the normal force that's pointing that way. So you know how this thing works. Basically, it starts with the floor there, and it spins up. As it spins up, the acceleration gets more, and the normal force gets more. And as the normal force gets big enough, a big enough frictional force is generated that it can support you against the force of gravity. So by controlling the spin of this cylinder, we're controlling the size of the normal force, kind of your apparent weight, and therefore controlling the frictional force, which is required to support you against gravity. Okay, so for example, we could calculate, if we say that that the coefficient of static friction is 0.3, how many revolutions per minute are required to hold you up? We can make the, I don't know what the particular problem was, but that's a problem. So in the y direction, there's no acceleration. So the frictional force has to be equal to the weight. And the normal force is causing the centripetal acceleration, which is omega squared r. And we know that the frictional force has to be no bigger than the static coefficient of friction times the normal force. So we've got mu static times m omega squared r has to be bigger than or equal to mg. And it's nice so that people like me and other people also can ride this ride without fear. The mass cancels out. And we have to spin this thing up until omega squared gets big enough so that it can support us against g. So omega squared better be bigger than, well, omega better be bigger than the square root of g divided by mu static and r. So we could make up numbers and calculate that if we wanted to. The kind of group work problem that was like this that I think no one got. Well, someone kind of got it. I gave them some points for it. So there was this amusement park ride where somebody swings out on a rope, basically. And we're told that this rope is swinging out at 30 degrees. And we're supposed to calculate, I don't know what, but we can calculate anything you want. So this is interesting because now we have things that aren't square, right? So our free body diagram, of course, has gravity going this way, and it has that string tension going like that. And alternating interior angles are the same, so this is 30 degrees. So the vertical force, that has to cancel because we're not rising or falling. So this piece of tension, which is T times the cosine of theta, it has to equal mg. And this piece of the tension, that's the thing that's causing the centripetal acceleration. So this is T sine theta. And if we're going around at rate omega, we know that the acceleration is, say, omega squared r. So the sum of the forces in this direction are T sine theta. That has to equal the mass times the acceleration in that direction. And we have the vertical force equation that T cosine theta has to be mg. And the easy way to solve this guy is just to divide those two equations by each other. You didn't like that. It's fair game, right? You can divide both equations by each other. I like it because the t's cancel out, and people have defined sine over cosine to be a button on my calculator, not a magic button, but a button, tangent of theta. So this is omega squared r divided by g. So I don't know what the problem was. I think in this particular case, we know what r is. And so maybe the problem was to figure out the value of omega that would be required in order for this thing to work. And I think you can see at this point it's a plug and chug.
Going back to this one, would we be able to just draw that free energy diagram?
So this is a free body diagram.
Free body, sorry.
Would
can
you?
We, like, just draw that body diagram on our cheat sheet? Like with the...
I don't want you to. You don't have to.
But
can that mean? So can means are you physically able, as opposed to will I rip your head off afterwards? I think the honest truth is it won't help. There's not, that problem isn't on the exam. So I won't have to rip your head off. So.
Suppose I think it helps.
Yeah.
Can I draw it on my...
Well, since it's not on the... So how strong is your head screwed on? I guess that's the question. And will I be able to pull it off or not? So you can put it on because you're nice. None of these other people can. There's nothing like that on the exam. It doesn't matter. If it makes you feel better, that's fine. So if the problem asks you for like revolutions per minute, it's probably going to be faster to go through that through omega, because that's very closely related to revolutions per minute. If it asks you for a speed, well, v squared over r is going to have that in it.
So that's basically what we're looking for?
Yeah, so you can go between one and the other by that equation. So if you find somehow one, you should be able to calculate the other.
Okay. So it doesn't really matter working for
it? No, nope, I would say it's the same. Because they're in the same direction.
But then the other two are in opposite directions, but they're steady
equation. Yeah, so they really added up to zero, right? So I should have maybe written that. Because
oh.
There's no acceleration in the y direction, and then come to this conclusion.
And then how do we know that the other two are
equal? Because F equals ma, right? This is the only force that's in the horizontal direction, and this is the mass times the acceleration in the horizontal direction. And Newton promises us that sum of the forces in any direction is equal to the mass times the acceleration in that direction.
Why did you not use v squared over r? Did you have the omega?
Because I was assuming that they were asking for revolutions per minute in the end.
Oh, okay.
Are you saying that my handwriting is less than perfect?
I'm saying my eyes are less than perfect.
You're nice. Which equation?
The very top one.
Yep. So I'll read it off to you. Okay. So this is calculating omega by unit conversion. So this is 45 revolutions per minute times 2 pi radians per rev times 1 minute is 60. I didn't write it seconds. I did write it, but you just didn't see it because of your bad eyes.
So if I can do
this here, she raised her hand. Ah, a statics problem.
Yes,
I will. Is your kind of a quickie question or not?
Yes. So all those problems you listed out that are relevant to our exam, the previous exams, like you can do those with confidence this exam.
You know I can't answer that question.
Didn't think you could.
Okay, so shall we do kind of the quiz question? Because that is kind of the bare question, and I more or less remember it. So for that question, we had this strut that was at 40 degrees, and it was attached to a 50 kilogram thing, and it weighed 10 kilograms, and it was attached to this string, which had some tension T. And there are obvious forces here, right? There's an obvious force of gravity, obvious force of gravity acting at the center of mass, obvious tension acting at that location. But there are unobvious forces too. This thing has to be pinned or it's going to be moving around. And so there has to be some force that is supporting it at that pin, and there has to be some force that is fighting that tension. And I can call these anything I want, but those forces have to be acting at that pin. They have to be. Otherwise it would be moving. So what I have then is the sum of the forces in the x direction has to be zero. So none of these guys are in the x direction, right? This is the normal xy setup. This guy is in the positive x direction. This guy is in the negative x direction. Sum of the forces in the x direction is zero. In the y direction, this is the only force that's in the positive y direction. This guy is in the negative y direction, minus 10g. This guy is in the minus y direction, minus 50g. Those forces all have to add up to zero. Well, I got three unknowns and two equations, so I need another equation, and that's going to be the torque equation. The sum of the torques have to be zero. And that anytime you're talking torque, you have to choose an origin. And I think the logical place, any origin will work, but this origin is going to make things particularly simple. Because that means that F and N, since they act right at that spot, have no twist. T is trying to twist this way, and these masses are trying to twist the other way, and those twists have to cancel, which is what it means to say that this total torque is zero. Okay, so one of the things I like about this particular problem is that it brings to mind the three different ways we have of calculating torque. So we can calculate torque by the moment arm times the force. So what do I mean by that? I mean make a line out of the action of the force and take a look at the perpendicular distance to the origin. Or you can use the full distance and take the perpendicular piece of the force. So I can figure out the perpendicular piece of that 50 kilograms times g, and I can apply that for the full 2 meters of that strut. Or I can take F times R times the sine of the angle between them. So I can take this force and this distance and this angle, which of course is 40 degrees, alternating interior angles, and I can calculate the torque that way. So any of those equations work, you just have to apply them. And to my taste, this formula works really well for that torque, and this formula works really well for these torques. But, you know, your mileage may vary. You can choose any one of those formulas and they have to give you the same answer. Okay, so, boy, it's really looking like a mess. So that says that you take the magnitude of the radius from the origin to the point of application of the force, multiply it by the force times the sine of the angle between those two. Say again?
Okay, I got that.
I think she. No. Did you mean that? What's the final torque equation?
Nope. No. I haven't gotten there yet. Okay. Yep. So this guy is a positive torque. So that's T times R times the sine of 40 degrees. This is a negative torque, and I'm going to use this equation for that. So I need this distance between the straight down distance of the 10 kilograms to this origin. And that's a cosine problem, right? Because it's a side that's adjacent to it. So I have minus 10g, that's the force, r times cosine of 40 degrees is the distance. And it works the same way for the 50 kilogram one, except that's 2 meters out. So the sum of all of those torques have to be zero. And now I immediately get what the tension is, right? I can put everything else, all the negative stuff on the other side of the equation. So I get 10g cosine 40 plus 50g times 2 times cosine 40, all on top of sine of 40, and I get what the tension is. So the sort of bare problems, look for the mysterious forces which are going to occur at hinged points. And typically what you're going to want to do then is choose that to be your origin, because you then eliminate some of those unknown forces. Otherwise, it's just the sum of the forces in the x direction is zero, some of the forces in the y direction is zero, some of the torques clockwise and counterclockwise are zero.
Would you have a mysterious force of the weight of the hinge pushing down to cancel your normal force pushing up?
So the whole strut, I'm not sure what you mean by the weight of the hinge, but the whole strut is equivalent to this point, the center of mass point. So all of the mass of the strut can be thought of as being at the center of mass. So that's a huge simplification. So I use this moment arm.
And how do you know how long that is?
Say again?
How do you know?
So the problem said that the strut was 2 meters long.
Okay.
So it's 2 meters times the cosine.
Okay.
But just for fun, let's do it the other way, right? So we did one this way, let's do it this way. So if this is 40 degrees, this is 50 degrees, right? And this has to be a right angle, because I want the perpendicular piece. So that means that this angle here is also 40 degrees. So I know what the hypotenuse is, and I want this adjacent side. So I think you can see that this is going to be 50g times the cosine of 40 degrees, just the way it was the other way. So repeat, if you're a fan of screencasts, all of the quiz problems from 191 are now online. The group work that we did exists as a PDF. And so homework problems are great. But I think the first thing you want to do is make sure you can do all of my favorite problems, which are the ones that are online. So online as in www.physics. So, and I guess the other thing, some people are looking for multiple choice sort of questions. So the conceptual questions at the end of the chapter are, I think at this point, your only source of multiple choice type questions. Yes, yes. So there are screencasts.
So you don't have anything that's specific from the conceptual ones?
So I don't have anything that's like hard copy or a PDF. It's as a screencast where I, it's virtual me, almost as good as the real me. Except you don't have to look at my face. So if you go to the usual class website. So I'm already on our usual spot here.
Right.
So if you go here to to MP4 lectures, you can't read it there, but there's something, there's a folder that's called physics. Mm-hmm. So you go there. And then these things are all screencasts. So the ones I was just, well, we could do a short one, I guess. So if I click on that, I wonder if that'll work. Out of memory. Okay. So that'll work.
Okay, but and so that has the multiple choice questions too, though, is what you're saying?
Yes. Yep. So the ones that are multiple choice are have MC in their name. I've never been out of memory before. That's interesting. Berkman. Screencast. Cursor. This. And see these ones that have capital MC in them, like that one?
Oh, okay.
So that will be pure multiple choice from test one.
Okay, got it.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, like there's nothing like that on the test, so it doesn't, doesn't matter to me.
Is that force of attraction problem down right there? Is that an equation similar to like Coulomb's law?
Yes, exactly like Coulomb's law. That's next semester.
Oh, I like taking notes.
I have to see what the school can answer to this because I keep hitting 4.7.
For this?
No. For this one, I couldn't read. It is 4.71.
Great minds think alike.
I can't see anything, apparently. I was reading this 1.76, and I was like,
no.
Getting so angry back there. All right. My eyes are always perfect during the summer that I come to school and I read so much.
Yeah, or you bash your head against walls.
Yes, and against other people.
I'm sure it is.
Why did I? I don't know.
I don't know why you're doing this.
I need about 20 cups of coffee.
Thank you.
Yep.